Welcome to Regulated and Relational, bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Today, Ginger and Julie are in the studio with a familiar voice, Jen Alexander, and she has brought Jennifer Dickey with her. Together, they have created a resource on executive functioning that you need to know more about. Let's listen in.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, our podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Julie Beam.
And I'm Ginger Healy.
And we're excited to share with you from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. Today, we're so excited to have two trauma-informed education experts in the studio with us, Ms. Jen Alexander and Jennifer Dickey. They have come to talk to us about executive functioning skills and specifically working memory. Ginger, can you give us a little introduction of both of these Jens?
Yes, absolutely. Now, I think everybody's going to recognize the name Jen Alexander. We have had you on the podcast before, Jen, and it's always been so well received because you are so experienced and knowledgeable in what you do. You are an experienced educator, nationally certified counselor, school-based registered play therapist, and also a very passionate leader in the movement to build trauma-sensitive schools. Jen Alexander is the author of Building Trauma-Sensitive Schools and Supporting Students and Staff After COVID-19. And I always like to play like, where in the world is Jen? Because you travel so much, so often all over the nation to help students. And we just love that about you. And I'm also excited to introduce you all to Jennifer Dickey. Jennifer's passion and expertise is in designing academic and affective supports for divergent thinkers. She is the founder of Lotus Cognitive Solutions Group, where she provides executive functioning coaching to children and adults with ADHD, dyslexia, and other learning differences. Jennifer has held a variety of roles in the education field, such as a classroom teacher, gifted and talented specialist, and academic language therapist, providing specialized instruction to dyslexic learners. She is also a full-time faculty member at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, and she's a visiting professor of education and teaches the courses in special education endorsement strand. So, wow, we are just excited to have you both here. You both have developed a new quick guide. The title of the quick guide is Supporting Students' Executive Functioning Skills in the Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, Focusing in on Working Memory. So that is a mouthful, and I just can't wait for you to break it all down for us. I think, Jennifer, if you would start us off talking about exactly what working memory is, why does it matter in school? I think that would be a great place to start.
That is a great place to start. And working memory does exist under that executive functioning umbrella. But working memory doesn't get the same limelight as its other executive function skills counterparts, even though the research tells us working memory is critical to school success. I liken working memory to a sticky note in our brain, which allows us to store information temporarily while we process that information and perhaps adapt or apply it in a new way. So it goes beyond straight memorization. It's taking in information that we actually need to do something with. So we see that every day in schools. We see students tapping into those working memory skills in reading. So we see our emergent and beginning readers needing to utilize their working memory capacity to decode words. They're looking at letters and they're trying to remember what sound each of the letter makes. Our more developed readers not only have to have that knowledge, and that knowledge needs to be automatic, but then they need to further that knowledge by making connections with text, summarizing, synthesizing, asking questions. So there's a heavier or greater demand on working memory capacity as the child develops. I think writing is another place where we often see students grapple with working memory capacity because the writing process is so complex. We are juggling and organizing our thoughts as we are simultaneously going through the kinesthetic process of putting those thoughts down onto paper. And that can be taxing and certainly taps into that executive function skill. Even simple things such as listening to and remembering multi-step directions that we're asking students to do all day long in a classroom setting, that also taps into those working memory skills. So I think that's an overview or a simplistic view of what working memory skills are and how we utilize those in a classroom setting.
Okay, so that makes total sense to me. And then the trauma-sensitive classroom part really comes from a question of how does stress impact that working memory? Right, Ms. Jen?
Yes, thank you so much for having us here today. And I'm happy to start addressing that question. I have to back up a little bit, though, because as Jennifer was talking about the writing process and how we have to hold all these different pieces of information to write, I was thinking that's what I was grappling with this morning, and it wasn't working very well as I was trying to write, which I think is such a good reminder that working memory is important for all of us, whether we've experienced big stress and trauma or not. What the research tells us about folks who have experienced trauma, whether they're youth or adults, is that when we're experiencing big stress, it makes it harder for us to hold information in our working memory.
Yes.
I think we've seen that. We can think of examples ourselves in our own lives when we've been overwhelmed by our life and then have trouble remembering information that someone just told us in the hallway. For instance, if a teacher comes up to me and says, "Miss Jen, we're changing our schedule today. Can we move our class time to this time instead of that one?" And I'm trying to hold it in my mind at the same time I'm carrying all of this stress, it can be really difficult. And when those moments happen myself, I can get hard on myself thinking, "Oh, I forgot that," or "I need to go back to them," even feeling shame about that. And if I experience that as an adult who's generally pretty successful in my world, what must that be like for a child or an adolescent who's carrying big stress and doesn't understand why they're having trouble remembering things? We also have to think of this in terms of how executive function skills develop, including working memory. We know that trauma in the early years of a child's life, think birth to three or even birth to five, impacts how the brain and nervous system develop. That includes how executive function skills like working memory develop. The other piece of research that's so critical to all of this is that substance use in utero can affect how executive function skills develop too. So we have lots of factors that can influence folks in the moment in terms of the load that they have on their upstairs brain and how that impacts working memory, but also in terms of past development or current development and how that's influencing functioning now. Sometimes when we see kids who are struggling with working memory, as educators, we interpret it as a problem with attention. So we try to cue attention instead of really opening up the possibilities to understand that working memory may be the real concern here. And when it is, there are different things that we would do rather than saying focus or pay attention or you're not doing the work, or even worse, you're choosing not to do the work. You're just uncompliant. That's missing the mark when working memory is really the issue. Because if I'm in the hallway and I've not been able to hold that piece of information about how this class needs to change, if somebody says to me, "Well, you're not trying to remember, you don't want to remember, you don't want to come to class," oh, now my shame is bigger. And I misunderstood, and I maybe even questioning myself as to, is that what's really going on? It's a can't, not a won't in that moment. And how we approach that can be supportive and maintain safety in relationships that allow us to meet that student right where they are. Because the reality of trauma-sensitive schools is that safety is the crux of everything. Our connectedness is really important. But if all we're doing is building that safety and then not addressing the upstairs brain supports that our students and faculty need to be successful, then we're perpetuating a situation where our focus is only on safety, connection, and regulation. We're not promoting learning. And that in itself leads to frustration and shame and can create a cycle of dysregulation too. So we want to focus on safety, connection, attunement in that relationship, really trying to broaden our understanding of what are the regulatory needs that the student has and what are the upstairs brain executive function supports that the student needs so that we can meet them where they are and help them be and feel successful in our classrooms.
You know, you said a lot there. And what you said in this last bit, I want to make sure that our listeners hear, is that in a trauma sensitive school, a trauma responsive school, whatever language you want to use, of course, we're going to focus on the safety piece of all of that. And we're going to focus on the relationships and on helping everyone to be regulated and helping students to develop their regulation strength, right? Their window of tolerance getting wider and wider. But if we don't get to the learning piece, then we really are, first of all, we're not doing the school part. That's what they're there for. But second of all, we're opening the window back up for that shame and that things to creep back in.
Well, I'm wondering if you can go back to, because I'm still swimming in all this too and processing everything you just said, and it's so critical. You had mentioned about that it actually even creates more safety to get to that next step. So maybe go back to that and dig a little deeper into that too.
Sure. And I think this is true for both Jennifer and I, that let's take a student, for example, who has a learning disability. Perhaps it's dyslexia. They have a reading disability. Mm-hmm. And when first encountering a student like this, no matter their age, we may see signs of dysregulation in them when reading comes up, or we might see it in relation to school at all, sure. You know, all over the place. I mean, that can be related to the dyslexia, can be related to dysregulation they're feeling in their body, related to all kinds of stressors that they might be facing. As we focus on that safety, that connection, that regulation in relationship, we might have to hold off on some learning tasks or alter them a bit until we can help the child or adolescent regulate through it. Mm-hmm. But if every time that dysregulation starts to come up, we back off on the academics, we say, oh, they're just not ready for it. Now what we're going to do is we're going to avoid the learning in order to promote regulation. That is never the goal. We're holding kids back from ambitious opportunities and access to learning when we do that. What we want to do is to be able to build a strong, safe relationship where they can trust us to work through that regulation, to co-regulate with us mm-hmm. in relationship. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens when we back off on that learning is we're not getting to the root of the learning difficulties that may be there for that student, particularly if the student has a learning disability like dyslexia. So what happens is we never get there. The student never feels any and experiences any success of co-regulating through those difficulties with us. Plus, they're not learning the reading skills. Now that can cause even more dysregulation because as they get older and that gap gets bigger between my skills and my peers, I feel even more shame. I'm not reading. I feel bad about myself and I just want to avoid it altogether. Now both student and adult might be avoiding that process, which gives us an opportunity to regulate through it together. And some of it's trial and error. We have to meet the kid where they are and learn and listen to them as we're teaching and noticing what's difficult for them. What's a strength for them? How can we build on that so that we can help them be authentically successful in this learning relationship?
Right. That's as I'm really listening tough. To you, I'm thinking about the statistics I know as an advocate for children who have disabilities, and that is that when their needs aren't met, when their learning needs aren't identified and met, over time, you end up with even more needs, right? You end up with a lot of behavioral and emotional needs. And what you're just describing is the flip side of that. How can we work with children who have backgrounds of already dysregulation, whether it's trauma or substance, some exposures or whatever has caused that, in addition to whatever their learning challenges are. I know there are listeners out there going, yeah, that's my child or that's my student, because that's not an uncommon thing for us to see. I don't know that there's a question in there, but you know, if either one of you wants to comment on that, please do.
I think there's one more thing I want to kind of clear up about what I said. And I talked about how stress and trauma impact executive function in the moment, including working memory. I mentioned a bit about how substance exposure in utero can impact development of executive function. Mm-hmm. One thing I didn't say that's really important to say is that trauma and substance use aren't the only things that impact the development of executive function. Right. The only thing that impacts learning disability. So I want to make sure that I'm clear about that, that lots of things can influence whether a student struggles with these skills. And the important thing is we don't have to know the why. We don't have to be able to pinpoint that or assess for that. We can meet them right where they are with the supports that really are targeting working memory skills.
Right.
Still good.
I would love to build off of what Ms. Jen had said, and that is, as educators, we have such a responsibility to look beyond student behaviors, and that is just imperative to what we do. When students are having trouble with working memory, they are sometimes mistakenly even labeled as or told that they're being inattentive or you're too distracted today, you're unfocused. Unfortunately, that can perpetuate and lead down a path to where we're calling children unmotivated, apathetic, or even disruptive or lazy. And if kids are constantly hearing that message, compounded with having a learning disability or another factor that is impacting their ability to meet expectations at school, it just continues to chisel away at their dignity, at their self-concept. And that's why we really need to look at what is the root cause here. Are we dealing with a child who has a limited working memory capacity? And what strategies can we put in place to remove some of those barriers, give kids supports they need so that they can be successful in the academic setting? Because Jen's right. We do see that achievement gap widen as kids get older. They call it the Matthew effect. As kids are unable to engage with grade level material, they get fewer opportunities, fewer exposures as they're on grade level peers. And so therefore the problem or the barriers compound. And we see that gap harder and harder to close as kids get older, unless they're given the appropriate supports, including really great instruction academically and with skill deficits as well.
I love that. I mean, I think that's where to go next. Talk to us about what works, what helps, what supports we can put in place to help students.
In the guide, we go into lots of different supports for working memory. And one of them that we want to highlight with you here today is the importance of using step-by-step checklists and even a visual form of what to do first, next, and then. And I think of this in really kind of two parts, how important it is to teach students the steps we want them to take instead of assuming that they will know them, or if we model it once they've got it, but to explicitly teach that, to practice that together, and to have a visual while we do that so that students can go back to that visual to cue them as to what step they're on. So that, like, let's say we have then an adolescent who's off task in the classroom, instead of going up to them and saying, oh, you're not getting started, or it's time to get to work, we can say, it looks like you're having some trouble getting going. Let's look at the first step on our list. That's your first thing to do. I'm going to let you get started with that. I'll come back and check on you in a moment. Let me know if you have any questions. I'm here to support you. Mm-hmm. So we do this give and take, this back and forth, this I see you, I notice you're struggling, I'm here to help you. It's an academic way of noticing the need and meeting the need. There's lots of different ways to do those kinds of visual step-by-steps or checklists. And of course, they're going to vary depending on the age. With little ones, we might use pictures mm-hmm. about what's first, next, last. With older students, we might have a numbered list. Hey, Mrs. Bond is a person who's wonderful to follow on social media, including Instagram. And she shared with us recently her kind of framework for how she teaches and cues youth to write an email to someone, step by step, how to do that, what needs to be included, with a little example for each part. I mentioned earlier that I'm writing. I have a sheet that I use that includes how to do citations according to the APA format for books or journal articles. And I have that next to me while I write so that I can refer to that and put that in correctly. These reminders that we use can help us not have to hold all that information in our working memory, but it can be offloaded in that visual form. And then we can access it to give us support to keep going. It lessens that load on that upstairs brain.
One of the things that you said that has resonated with me is, instead of just saying, okay, here's your checklist, here's what to do, ask me if you have any questions, is that you're going back and you're checking in and you're prompting and saying, this looks hard, let me help you out. And that is so much more powerful, because I mean, I'll never forget Jim Sporleader telling me that if you say to a student, let me know if you have any questions, they'll never come to you. But if you're coming up and checking in and saying, it looks like you need a little help, then they'll engage with you and you can get more done. I love that you brought that out.
Yeah. And that you're starting with just that first step, because sometimes, mm-hmm. and especially the more you progress through school, the more multi-step the instruction becomes, right? So if I have seven things to do and I already know I struggle with that, then just looking at the list of seven feels overwhelming. But if you help me zero in that this is where I start, then it feels a lot less overwhelming.
And sometimes it's even a matter of making it a checkbox next to each of those things, so it can be checked off as you go, because then it feels like, oh, I accomplished something. Yes. I got it. That's regulating too. Jennifer, I think you should share your example from your college course that you shared with me as we were working on this project, because it's such a powerful example of how adults need working memory support too.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to back up one step real quick, because I do think the more we can lean in with curiosity, I'm even thinking of, you know, younger students that I've worked with, and we might have the same routine that we expect kids to go through every day. You hang up your backpack, you hang up your coat, you put your lunch in the lunchbox. But even routine, familiar processes or directions, working memory is fluid. It isn't fixed, right? So instead of assuming that a child is choosing not to follow all of those steps, I think it's important that we ask questions and understand why certain steps are being dropped, and talk to the student about what we can do to help support them, suggesting ideas, but listening to what's going on there too. Not assuming that it's a choice, that there might be a skill deficit where we're dropping pieces of that familiar routine off to at home. I hear from parents all of the time, bedtime routine is so hard. I ask them to go get ready for bed, and 20 minutes later, not one step in the process has been done. So that's indicative that a child might need further supports to help them get through that routine.
I love it that you brought that up, and the point that these skills are fluid, because it also lends to this understanding about how when we do this for all kids, it's good for everybody, because I might need more working memory support one day than I do another day. And that's true for our students too. So when those steps are posted, anybody who needs that support that day can access it and cue into that. And on another day, it may be just part of the rhythm that they're accustomed to because it's so practiced and they won't need that support. But those who do, it's there for them.
We see these transitions in life, and that's an interesting point. I always think of the odd years in school, first, third, fifth, seventh, all of these transition points where working memory demands increase, our expectations of children increase, develop from a developmental perspective. And as you think about those ages through school, along the way, we're slowly peeling back the adult support that comes with that. So increased expectation, lessen adult support. Those are when we really see those working memory deficits come to the surface. And that's when I see students needing those extra supports. I work with college students, so I teach in the higher ed world. And I see my college students needing support with that as they make that transition to this new independent world where they're in charge of their life and managing multiple things. So, you know, even for 20 somethings, I'm trying to build in structure and consistency. That's a really important piece to scaffolding any working memory deficits. And so we do spend the first 5 minutes of class looking at the syllabus, and students have 24/7 access to the syllabus. It's online, it lives online, but that's not always enough. So we intentionally look at that. We look at our current class and we look two classes ahead, because I do want them to be forward thinking. And that really is an opportunity for them to then, either with their digital planner or paper planner, start allocating your time. How are you going to manage these deliverables, these to-dos, if you will? And I have a lot of students that want to go all digital, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there are several students who are grappling and drowning in the sea of to-dos. And we put together a plan for them to put in their own handwriting what their tasks are for that day, for that week. And I tell them, you know, sometimes if the assignment doesn't exist in your own handwriting, it doesn't exist. It is not on their timeline. And so that can be really powerful and give them a sense of ownership and empowerment of the things that they are expected to get done.
I love that. I have two college age kids, and I find that they still, of course, need regulation moments and support. In fact, I got a call this morning from one of them who something didn't go their way according to plan. And it was a big deal because we're getting towards the end of the semester and everything is hinging on this final project. And when they rented film equipment for this, you know, film project and the film equipment wasn't available, everything had a domino effect. And so we had to talk through what next, what can we do? And as I'm listening to you talk about writing it down, it's just like blowing my mind because that's exactly what I'm realizing he needed, because he has his own way of understanding what he's trying to say. Like if I write him a note, that's different than him writing it and understanding what he meant. Like he's understanding, you know what I'm trying to get here too.
I do. It's fascinating because we do this with kids. We do this with young kids. When we are teaching kids phonics, we use multi-senses. We use visual, we use, you know, auditory, and we also use kinesthetic. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is missing from our digital world. But you're right. Even adults, when we put something in our own penmanship, our own handwriting, I think it contributes to how we process that information and compartmentalize
it. That's what yes. I was getting to. You're right, because I know how he processes and it's systematic. He has a sequential pattern that he goes through. And so what you're hitting on, I can see how that would help him organize in a different way mm-hmm. and remember mm-hmm. and understand steps. So
I'm going to attest to all of that for myself, because, you know, now with more digital age sort of things and going to presentations and listening to them as an adult, I don't know how many times people are like, oh, we'll give you the slides afterwards. Well, I don't want the slides afterwards. I want to write down what you said that I wanted to remember. And then I never really even have to look at those notes again, because the act of writing them down did something. If I didn't write it down when I got your slides, it wouldn't mean anything to me. And I just thought it was my quirky brain, but now you've given me a context for that. So yeah, writing it in your own handwriting makes perfect sense to me.
And you probably had more suggestions and I just jumped in and cut you off because I was like, I need that strategy. But I'm sure there are other things that work just as well that you could implement as well.
So I would love to know more, since I now found out that I don't have that quirky brain. I would like to know about how this works for adults, specifically for teachers. And, you know, maybe even young teachers who are still learning what they need to learn about working memory. So what ideas can you give there?
I think all of us recognizing that teachers are carrying a tremendous amount of stress and responsibility that impacts their executive function capacity in any moment, and in turn affects working memory, is huge. Anything school leaders and also teams of teachers can do to help one another offload what's in their own working memory, the better. One of the things I did as a teacher is I tried to just carry sticky notes with me all the time. So if someone stopped me in the hall, I could jot that down and I didn't have to hold it in my brain.
Good idea.
And teacher conferences will be coming up at different times throughout the year. How can your team get together and kind of offload the list of all the things that need to be done and then work with it and move it around? In terms of, we do this first, then this is the next chunk, and this is the last. Anything that school leaders can do to provide a checklist like that for all teachers, but especially for educators who might be in a new role because they're carrying mm-hmm. all the demands, the new curriculum that they're trying to hold, the stress that comes with that. That can be teachers who are new to a new grade level or a new subject, or who are new to teaching altogether. Anytime we go through a transition like that, there's more load on our upstairs brain. So anything we can do to offload that, to provide a checklist, or to give time for folks to work together to create that together so that they have what they need to be successful is a good thing for everyone.
And how do I, as an educator, know I need that kind of help? I mean, I'm just thinking through my own personal experience with working memory. Sometimes I'm not sure that I'm overwhelmed until I'm just really deeply overwhelmed. What are some clues that maybe I am trying to rely on my working memory too much, or my stress is too great to get what my normal working memory level is? How do I know that?
I think it's knowing your own cues when you're becoming dysregulated. So knowing what tends to show up for you when you are becoming overwhelmed, and then assuming that that's going to come with some working memory lags along with it, that would be expected for any of us. So anytime you're stressed, which really as an educator is a lot of the time. Yes. So anything we can do, not necessarily to wait until we're struggling, but to do it anyway, to do it all the time with big tasks that might be coming up is helpful. I think anytime that we're just noticing that cognitive overload, feeling tired, just feeling forgetful, getting hard on ourselves, why can't I hold this information, or what's wrong with me? Or maybe judging a colleague in that way. What's wrong with them? Why can't they hold this? Why aren't they following through? To take that step back instead of, you know, what's wrong with you, but what could be happening for them right now? Right. We don't need to know their story necessarily of the stress that they're carrying and why, but understanding enough about stress and trauma's effects to realize they could be overwhelmed by some stuff, whether we know about it or not, and it could be impacting.
Right. I think it works for everybody. If we always have that attitude, especially with a child, that, you know, assistance is not a bad thing. Asking for help is not a bad thing. Offering help is not a bad thing. We don't just need to assume that everybody's on their A game every day. It's just not going to happen. So why not go in with that compassion, you know, because there are things you've given us such great ideas of what we can do to help. I mean, that's the goal at the end of the day, is to help everyone do better, no matter if it's a child or a colleague or an adult. You know, that we can really intervene with some good help here to make everybody successful. There's just, I think, ideas there that can really benefit everybody going in with that compassionate attitude of help. We definitely want to know how we can get the guide, where we can get the guide. So if you'll give us all the contact information to reach the both of you and the guide, we want to make sure we shout that out.
Again, the guide is called Supporting Students' Executive Function Skills in the Trauma-Sensitive Classroom, focusing in on working memory. The guide is 8 panels. It's colorful with practical information that folks can start using right away with youth and adults of any age and developmental need. It reviews how working memory functions and the role it plays in school success for both youth and adults. You'll learn how to recognize working memory challenges in your students. We talked about some of those today. There's more in the guide. It helps you change your thinking about students who struggle with working memory. We want you to be able to make that paradigm shift around what's difficult for them versus what's something they're not putting any effort into. That's rarely what the cause is. And then it's full of specific tips, strategies, and tools to support everybody's working memory at school. There are also downloads, handouts, activities, and even a lesson plan or two that are included.
Comprehensive. That's great.
Chock full of good things. And I think we just want to reiterate that your working memory is not fixed. It's something we can explicitly teach kids and we can practice. There are strategies that we can implement. We know we can help kids and adults develop working memory skills.
What an amazing resource. It's bite-sized so that busy educators can just get that information and go. So are there other quick guides in the work around executive functioning skills?
We have more in the works. We're going to tackle other working memory topics. And then there are other quick guides coming that are not related to executive function. For instance, gentle movements for the classroom, and that includes a trauma-sensitive approach, is well on the way. And the next one after that, the title is still in the works, but it's focused on the importance of anti-racist work as trauma-sensitive educators. Mm-hmm. Really excited to get these out in the hands of our practicing educators. We're here to help you, and we care about the work you're doing because it's important, it matters, and your needs in the work matter too. Thanks so much for having us here today.
Well, I enjoyed it with both of you. I mean, we are so fortunate to have you here with us today.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you having us on the show.
Okay. Well, folks, please check out this quick guide to supporting students' executive functioning skills in a trauma-sensitive classroom. This one is focusing on working memory, which is really an important aspect of that executive functioning and an important aspect for not just students, but educators as well. Thanks for joining us in this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Hi, everyone. It's Julie Beam, and I want to remind you that the 7th annual Creating Trauma-Sensitive Schools Conference is right around the corner. We will be meeting the week of President's Day in February. So from the 18th to the 20th, we will be in person in Dallas, Texas, and you don't want to miss this conference. If you can't make your way to Dallas, we have got an equally amazing group of speakers and workshops on our virtual conference, which is the 22nd and 23rd, and you can join us from a computer near you. We've got the greatest keynotes, y'all. I can't even begin to tell you. We're going to kick off the week on Monday in Dallas with Dr. Ross Green, the founder of the CPS model. Ross has spoken as a keynote for us before, and what he has to say about how to view behaviors is so critical for us to start understanding what it truly means to shift our thinking into trauma-informed care. We're going to have a town hall meeting led by Dr. Lori DeSautel. And then on the virtual side, Dr. Stuart Shanker and Susan Hopkins, who just did a podcast with us recently, will be our opening keynotes on Thursday. And on Friday, you all, we're going to be joined by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, the author of The Deepest Well. She is the first ever, now former, Surgeon General of the state of California, and such an icon in the trauma-informed movement. We're going to have a conversation with her about how educators, how community leaders, how parents can get involved in the trauma-informed movement. It will be so worth your time. And this year is the first year we're going to be able to offer academic credit, graduate level credit for both sides of the conference. One credit hour in Dallas, one credit hour virtually. You want to check that out as well. You can find out more at conference.attachtrauma.org. That's conference.attachtrauma.org. Sign up soon. It's not very many days until we'll be seeing you in Dallas or on your computer.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Join us next time for the last episode of Season 3, right before the 2024 Creating Trauma-Sensitive Schools Conference. Next time, Yvonne Johnson, the National PTA President, will be here to speak about PTA's trauma-informed initiatives. Special thank you to Joe Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at www.attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Lorraine Schneider. Thanks for listening.